Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. We are going to talk more about POCUS this week, and I always enjoy talking about ultrasound. I think this is one that I use quite a bit, especially for any eye complaints, and that is ocular ultrasound. Really, ocular ultrasound has changed the way I see eye complaints. I used to dread it because I could never get a good enough look in the posterior chambers to really feel comfortable with my diagnosis and my management of these patients. Now, having ultrasound, I'm able to identify so many more complications and issues that can arise, and I really feel better about my general management. In fact, recently I've even seen a couple of cases of retinal detachment, which I was able to better manage because of my use of ultrasound. And we're going to talk about some of the evidence that has come out recently, but I want to mention two things first. My first announcement is that it is PA week, so if you see or know a PA, thank them for all they do, and if you are a PA, keep doing the great job that you do every single day. I included this study specifically because it helps with National PA Week, because it talks in this study specifically about how they use PAs, which is not something we frequently see in where they have PAs right alongside the physicians and residents doing the studies. So I thought this was awesome. I thought it was a great way to tie in PA Week while still teaching some fundamental parts of our management and exams that we can use. The second announcement is that please don't forget our sponsor, Practical POCUS. This is an exam that they talk about in a lot of their courses, if not all of them. It just kind of depends on the length of the course you may take. If you're taking a shorter course, sometimes it's not included, but in the more comprehensive courses, this is a common topic because of how beneficial it can be. Now, I know some people out there may hold some doubt about how important an ocular exam is with the use of ultrasound as an aid. But like I said, I've seen some of these patients recently, and I've been doing this for the last few years, and it has really helped me improve my management of these patients. So if you want to learn more about Practical POCUS, because there's all different types of courses that exist, there are online courses that are now being done where basically you have an ultrasound machine, you're being taught at a distance. It's great for those who are working internationally or work in rural remote locations where they may not be able to attend a course in person. That is what it was designed for. And they stay in small ratios, so there's still tons of help to help guide you through the process without having to physically go somewhere. Preferably, the ones I prefer are going in person and teaching. There will be some courses coming in 2020 that will be throughout the country, and definitely keep a close eye on that. If you go to practicalpocus.com, you can actually sign up to receive those updates when those courses come. I do know that there will be a course at the St. Louis Zoo at some point. The date will be announced soon. So if you want to plan for a vacation with your kids where they can have a great place to hang out and where you can enjoy yourself as well, the St. Louis Zoo is a great place to go. Again, a lot more details about that coming very soon. And they also do courses where they will come to you and teach. So we do this with different educational programs, such as PA programs, since we're mentioning PA Week, also for different businesses and specialties. So different emergency departments, even specialists like orthopedic surgery clinics. There's plenty of roles for ultrasound, and Practical POCUS is there to help out. Okay, so enough about the little plug in there for those two things. Again, happy PA week, and check out practicalpocus.com to learn more about that great educational group. Now let's talk about the actual content. What brings you in today? And that is, again, point of care ultrasound or POCUS for the eye. This is something that I think an easier exam to do because the eye is something that was meant to be ultrasound. And the reason why I say that, it's very superficial, so we get great detail easily with the right appropriate probe, and it contains mostly fluid. So it's very echogenetic and really something that we can see clearly on ultrasound. So it's safe, it's easy to do, and it can significantly improve your management by accurate diagnosis of pathology. And so for me, like I said, most eye complaints, especially anything where there are vision changes or where maybe deeper structures of the eye. So for example, the corneal abrasion without any other evidence of injury or complaint or maybe that foreign body that can sometimes be a little challenging to see, ocular ultrasound is probably going to be something where you may consider it. But if it's, again, a very superficial, easy to identify foreign body or corneal abrasion or maybe just conjunctivitis, yeah, those are probably the times I'm not going to use ocular ultrasound. But for anything else eye-related, I'm pretty much going to be using it every single time unless I've got something else going in mind, which I think I need to add this now. I know I had planned to mention it later too, but I think it's very important to mention right now. There are patients where you should not do ocular ultrasound. The main one are going to be people that you're worried about globe injury, specifically globe rupture. But if there is any chance and you're seriously considering that this could be a globe rupture, do not use ultrasound. The reason behind this is because you could potentially put pressure on the eye itself. And by putting that pressure there, you can cause more of the vitreous to leak. And we definitely don't want that. We want that globe to be as intact as possible for the best outcome. So if there's any question of, you know, open trauma to the eye, where basically the globe is communicating, then we want to avoid this at all possible. Outside of that, it's pretty safe and it's pretty easy to do. There are specific ophthalmic settings. You have to have the right ultrasound to do that. If you don't, you could, and I stress could, this is something that you should clarify with your manufacturer and really have something planned in place. But there are settings that you can use where you can get around the ophthalmic issue. What most people that I know who are doing that, they're using like a soft tissue or small organ setting, and they're doing it with a linear probe for very brief periods of time. Again, ophthalmic is preferred because it's specifically FDA approved for that. So just keep in mind that this may be an off-label use depending on the ultrasound machine that you have in your department and those capabilities. But I think that risk is, again, more theoretical when it comes to the use of the ultrasound itself. It's still an important one to consider and keep in the back of your mind as we talk about this. But let's assume you have the appropriate technology and equipment to facilitate this. Like I said, the big thing is no globe injuries. And I am using a ton of gel anyway. I'm not putting any pressure on the eye. And on most of these clips that you're going to see, there will be a layer, a buffer, because you should not be putting direct pressure onto the eye no matter what. So again, that globe rupture may not be a huge deal, but it's a theoretical issue and you definitely don't want to make things worse. So please don't do it. Because if nothing else, when it comes to wiping the gel off, you're going to have to push maybe a little bit, the slightest bit. And again, we want to avoid that if all possible. Okay, now that I have not only my little plugs at the beginning, but also my disclaimer in there and the initial use of ultrasound, let's go ahead and actually talk about what brings us to using ocular ultrasound the most. And the big things that you can identify with ocular ultrasound, keep in mind there are plenty more, are retinal detachment, lens dislocation, vitreous detachment or hemorrhage, optic nerve sheath diameter, and retained foreign bodies. Now, the retained foreign bodies one is something I'll frequently add to that list because it's not a lot of times mentioned there. But if there's a foreign body that may not be clearly visualized, or if there is a foreign body where I'm questioning its depth, because sometimes these foreign bodies have maybe been there for a little while and the farmer comes in a couple of days later because it's still in their eye and they couldn't get it out and now things are getting worse, I like to actually be able to sometimes look to see the depth behind it. I've been surprised a couple of times where it communicates much deeper than I originally thought. So the main study that we're going to talk about today is one from JAMA. And whether you call it JAMA, JAMA, it doesn't matter. For me, the great part about this study is that, like I said at the very beginning, it includes physicians, residents, and PAs. The paper itself is titled Point-of-Care Ultrasonography in the Diagnosis of Retinal Detachment, Vitreous Hemorrhage, and Vitreous Detachment in the Emergency Department. It was published April 12, 2019, and it is an open access article, so make sure to check it out. I do have a link in the show notes, just like I have a couple of images, as always, in the show notes as well. Again, go to totalem.org, and you'll be able to find it from there. Their clinical question was how accurate point-of-care ultrasound is for diagnosing retinal detachment, vitreous hemorrhage, and vitreous detachment. I believe this is a great question because this is exactly what ocular ultrasound was meant to help out with. Because again, our other things like an ophthalmoscope, yeah, if you get really good at it, maybe if you have the panoptic, for example, I have no conflicts of interest on this or anything I'm specifically mentioning, but the panoptic is supposed to have a better view. Great if you have it, but even then, it's still a pain and you still have to have compliance with the patient. And I feel like I'm not getting as good of a view as what I can see with ultrasound. If you have a slit lamp, man, that's amazing if you have it. Do you know how to use it? Are you good at it? Do you feel like that's effective? Again, you have to have someone who's willing to open their eye. Maybe sometimes that's the issue. But also, it can be a real challenge to be good at it. It takes lots and lots of practice at it, and you have to keep up with that practice. Plus, like I said, you have to have it around. And most of the EDs I've ever been in do not have a slit lamp. And if they have a slit lamp, ask someone to find it, and good luck trying to find the damn thing because it is hard to do. So if you don't have a slit lamp exam and you don't have a good ophthalmoscope or a good way to use your ophthalmoscope, whether that's patient compliance or because of lack of use, whatever, man, it gets really hard really quickly. But again, ocular ultrasound is easy to do. Now, that's not to say you can't have no training, but it doesn't take much. In fact, in this study, with the physicians, residents, and PAs. Now, given they come from different backgrounds and different levels of use of the ultrasound, but they all received a 30-minute lecture plus 30 minutes of hands-on scanning time on healthy volunteers, and they still did a pretty good job as far as what they were able to see. And again, that was a total of 75 clinicians, so 70 of them being residents and physicians, the other five being PAs. Which is a pretty good mix. And yes, I'd love to have seen more PAs, but even to have any PAs in this study, I think is a huge bonus here. So what they did was they looked at four different emergency departments, two that were academic and two that were country hospitals, which I assume were rural, as a multi-center prospective observational convenience sample. And all these sites had EM residents, they had ophthalmology residents, and they had an emergency ultrasound fellowship. They enrolled patients between 8 a.m. to 12 a.m. By research assistants, and POCUS was performed by the treating clinician prior to consultation with an ophthalmologist. The ophthalmologist would have been blinded to the POCUS results, and they could report more than one diagnosis, just like the person who is performing the ultrasound could mention more than one diagnosis. The POCUS diagnoses were then compared to the final diagnoses of the ophthalmologist after their examination. The inclusion criteria was pretty simple. It included any symptoms suspicious for retinal detachment, vitreous hemorrhage, or vitreous detachment, with examples such as blurry vision, flashes, floaters, or vision loss. And the other inclusion portion is that they had to have an ophthalmic consultation. Now, the exclusion criteria, this is probably going to make a lot of sense, but if there was no ophthalmic consultation, if the patient was younger than 18 years of age, if the patient could not speak English or Spanish, if the patient declined enrollment, if there was incomplete data, or most importantly, as we were talking about earlier, no ocular trauma or suspicion for globe rupture being present. And I think, again, the globe rupture is a biggie and one that we need to consider. What do they define? How do they define the pathology? I think that's an important one for something like this because sometimes it can be hard to tease that out correctly. Retinal detachment was defined as a bright echogenetic membrane tethered to the optic disc but separated from the choroid. And if you're trying to remember your anatomy, again, if you go to the Total EM website and go to emergency professionals, you'll be able to see different images, including the labeled anatomy of the eye, so you can see what exactly we're talking about there. For the next definition, that would be posterior vitreous detachment, and that was defined as a detached thin mobile membrane at the interface between the vitreous and the retina. And then a vitreous hemorrhage was a fluid collection of variable echogenicity in the posterior chamber that rotated with kinetic examination. Now, I will tell you that you'll see on retinal detachments that it'll flap around with kinetic exam as well. And that can sometimes really help you tease out to a retinal detachment. There were a total of 225 patients with a mean age of 51 years of age, and 40% of these were female. They found pathology in 36% of them. I was actually really impressed that over a third of these patients had some form of pathology. And keep in mind, it was going to be over 20% of the total numbers that they have, but they found 20.8% had a retinal detachment, 24% had vitreous hemorrhage, and 15.1% had a vitreous detachment. The sensitivities of each of these were pretty impressive. So retinal detachment, it was 97%, vitreous hemorrhage was 82%, and then vitreous detachment was 42%. So a little low for the vitreous detachment, but the other two, the retinal detachment and the vitreous hemorrhage, was pretty impressive. The specificities were actually pretty good across the board. For retinal detachment, it was 88%. For vitreous hemorrhage, it was 82%. And for vitreous detachment, it was 96%. Like I said, these were overall pretty solid results. However, I feel like compared to previous studies that this was a little bit lower than what I was expecting. A meta-analysis for retinal detachment has shown a sensitivity of 94% and a specificity of 96%, which is what I'd more expect. These are not horrible numbers in this study, but it is bigger. Maybe there are some other issues involved with it. I think there are a couple of things to keep in mind, though. This was a convenient sample. There was no inter-rater reliability. And this was multi-center in design, but most of these came from one center. About 77% of them came from one center, and the rest of them came for the others, with one of them only having four studies done. So given the high prevalence of the disease too, I think that's something else to keep in mind, because these were pretty high numbers and pretty high likelihoods for this to occur. So I think this is something that maybe this could play a role in why the numbers were the way they are. But again, I would like to see how this data compares, if maybe it was added in a meta-analysis, and how much that would shift the numbers around. But overall, keep in mind that your sensitivity and specificity, in most cases, it seems is around the 90s, which isn't perfect by any means. You still need to have an ophthalmologist if you're really worried about any of these pathologies. But this could really help change your diagnostic momentum if we have a positive exam. So I am taking away that as the key point is, like many ultrasound exams, a positive is going to be much more beneficial, I think, and much more helpful in most cases than a negative would be. A negative exam with an eye, with someone I'm really worried about, maybe they still complain of vision loss. Well, all that really tells me is that I don't have a specific cause yet, but there's something more to investigate with it. So hopefully this has been a good review. I think there are some steps to come in ocular ultrasound research. One thing I'd like to see is see how patient-oriented outcomes may change when we use ocular ultrasound versus our routine assessment and management. So if we have someone follow up with an ophthalmologist one to do days, A, do they actually do it? Versus if you have someone come into the emergency department because, man, you found that retinal detachment. And I think the biggest one of those is it a macula on or a macula off retinal detachment? Because a mac on retinal detachment is a big deal. If you can save these people's vision by catching it early, you can totally change outcomes there. But if they have a mac off, then these patients, they still need urgent follow-up and management, and they will probably still have surgery and stuff like that. But the long-term situation for these patients, what happens down the line, is going to be a little bit different. And so the mac on versus mac off can be a big deal in helping better manage these patients. So I'd highly encourage you to, if you're listening out there, you like ocular ultrasound, you want to do a study, that maybe that's something to look at, is the difference with mac on, mac off, and how that changes outcomes, and how accurate are we at diagnosing the difference between the two. I, like I said, had a couple of cases recently, with one being very clearly a mac off, the other one being very clearly what I felt like was a mac on, because the rest of the presentation. And it did change the management. The mac off one was someone who still got seen pretty quickly. It was kind of a next day visit, and it did confirm the diagnosis with that ophthalmologist, just like the mac on was confirmed with the diagnosis by that ophthalmologist who saw them and took them to surgery. But we have to keep in mind that we need to have the appropriate management. And I think having some further research to help tease that out would be very interesting to see. So, like I said, if you want to learn more about this, check out the show notes where you can read the paper, you can see some basic images, but attend an ultrasound course. Again, Practical POCUS is a great option, does a lot of great stuff, provides a year of support afterwards. Like I said, it's something that I find very beneficial. If you're going to be taking care of patients with eye complaints, which be something that may help strengthen your arsenal and better improve your management. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.